This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents 16th Seduction, written by James Patterson and Maxine Petro, read by January Lavoie. For Harry Cronin. Prologue. The Man Known as Jay. 1. That muggy morning in July, my partner, Rich Conklin, and I were on stakeout in the Tenderloin, one of San Francisco's sketchiest, most crime-ridden neighborhoods. We had parked our 1998 gray Chevy sedan where we had a good view of the six-story apartment building on the corner of Leavenworth and Turk. It's been said that watching paint dry is high entertainment compared with being on stakeout, but this was the exception to the rule. We were psyched and determined. We had just been assigned to a counterterrorism task force reporting back to Warren Jacoby, chief of police, and also Dean Reardon, deputy director of Homeland Security based in D.C. This task force had been formed to address a local threat by a global terrorist group known as GAR, which had claimed credit for six sequential acts of mass terrorism in the last 5 days. They were equal ethnicity bombers, hitting three holy places, a mosque, a cathedral, and a synagogue, as well as two universities and an airport, killing over 900 people of all ages and nationalities in six countries. As we understood it, GAR, Great Anti-Establishment Reset, had sprung from the rubble of Middle Eastern terror groups. Several surviving leaders had swept up young dissidents around the globe, including significant numbers of zealots from Western populations who'd come of age after the digital revolution. The identities of these killers were undetectable within their home populations, since GAR's far-flung membership hid their activities inside the dark web, an internet underground perfect for gathering without meeting. Still, they killed real people in real life. And then they bragged. After a year of burning, torturing, and blowing up innocent victims, GAR published their mission statement. They plan to infiltrate every country and bring down organized religion and governments and authorities of all types. Without a known supreme commander or national hub to target, blocking this open-source terrorism had been as effective as grasping poison gas in your hand. Because of GAR's unrelenting murderous activities, San Francisco, like most large cities, was on high alert on that 4th of July weekend. Conklin and I had been told very little about our assignment, only that one of the presumed GAR operatives, known to us as Jay, had recently vaulted to the number one spot on our government's watch list. Over the last few days, Jay had been spotted going in and out of the dun-colored tenement on the corner of Turk and Leavenworth, the one with laddered fire escapes on two sides, and a lone tree growing out of the pavement beside the front door. Our instructions were to watch for him. If we saw him, we were to report his activities by radio, even as eyes in the skies were on this intersection from an AFB in Nevada or Arizona or Washington, D.C. It was a watch-only assignment, and when a male figure matching the grainy image we had, of a bearded man, 5'9", hat shading his face, left the dun-colored apartment building, we took note. When this character crossed to our side of the street and got into a white refrigerator van parked in front of the TL Market in Delhi, we phoned it in. Conklin and I have been partners for so many years and can almost read each other's minds. We exchanged a look and knew that we couldn't just watch a suspected terrorist pull out into our streets without doing something about it. I said, "Following is watching." Rich said,
"Just a second, Lindsay, okay?"
His conversation with the deputy was short. Rich gave me the thumbs up and I started up the car. We pulled out two car lengths behind the white van, driven by a presumed high-level terrorist known as Jay. 2. I edged our shark-like Chevy along Turk and turned left on Hyde, keeping just far enough behind Jay's van to stay out of his rear view while keeping an eye on him. After following him through a couple of turns, I lost the van at a stoplight on 10th Street. I had to make a split-second decision whether or not to run the light. My decision was go. My hands were sweating on the wheel as I shot through the intersection and was blasted by a cacophony of horns, which called attention to us. I didn't enjoy that at all. Conklin said,
"There he is."
The white van was hemmed in by other vehicles traveling at something close to the speed limit. I kept it in our sights from a good distance behind the pack. And then the van merged into U.S. Route 101 south toward San Jose. The highway was a good, wide road with enough traffic to ensure that Jay would never pick our Chevy out of the flow. Conklin worked the radio communications, deftly switching channels between Chief of Police Warren Jacoby and DHS Deputy Director Dean Reardon, who was three time zones away. Dispatch kept us updated on the movements of other units in our task force that were now part of a staggered caravan weaving between lanes, taking turns at stepping on the gas, then falling back. We followed Jay's van under the sunny glare on 101 South, and after 12 miles, instead of heading down to San Jose and the Central Coast, he took the lane that funneled traffic to SFO. Conklin had Jacoby on the line.
"Chief, he's heading toward SFO.
Several voices crackled over the radio, but I kept visual contact with the man in the van that was moving steadily toward San Francisco International Airport. That van was now the most frightening vehicle imaginable. Gar had sensitized all of us to worst-case scenarios, and a lot of explosives could be packed into a vehicle of that size. A terrorist wouldn't have to get on a plane or even walk into an airline terminal. I could easily imagine Jay crashing his vehicle through luggage check-in and ramming the plate glass windows before setting off a bomb. Conklin had signed off with Jacoby and now said to me,
"Lindsay, SFO security has sent fire trucks and construction vehicles out to obstruct traffic on airport access roads in all directions."
Good. I stepped on the gas and flipped on the sirens. Behind us, others in our team did the same, and I saw flashing lights getting onto the service road from the north. Passenger cars pulled onto the shoulder to let us fly by, and within seconds we were passing Jay's van as we entered the international departures lane. Signs listing names of airlines appeared overhead. SFO's parking garage rose up on our right. Off-ramps and service roads circled and crossed underneath our roadway, which was now an overpass. The outline of the international terminal grew closer and larger just up ahead. Rich and I were leading a group of cars heading to the airport when I saw cruisers heading away from the terminal right toward us. It was a high-speed pincer movement. Jay saw what was happening and had only two choices, keep going or stop. He wrenched his wheel hard to the right, and the van skidded across to the far right lane where there was one last exit to the garage, which 100 yards farther on had its own exit to South Link Road. The exit was open and unguarded. I screamed to Conklin, "Hang on!" I passed the white van on my right, gave the Chevy more gas, and turned the wheel hard, blocking the exit. At the last possible moment, as I was bracing for a crash, Jay jerked his wheel hard left and pulled around us. By then, the airport roadway was filled with law enforcement cruisers, their lights flashing, sirens blowing. The van screeched to a halt. Adrenaline had sent my heart rate into the red zone, and sweat sheeted down my body. Both my partner and I asked if the other was okay as cop cars lined up behind us and ahead of us, forming an impenetrable vehicular wall. A security cop with a megaphone addressed Jay.
"Get out of the vehicle. Hands up. Get out now, buddy. No one wants to hurt you."
Would Jay go ballistic? I pictured the van going up in a fiery explosion 40 feet from where I sat in an old sedan. I flashed on the image of my little girl when I saw her this morning, wearing baby duck yellow, beating her spoon on the table. Would I ever see her again? Just then, the white van's passenger door opened, and Jay jumped out. A voice, amplified through a bullhorn, boomed, "Don't move! Hands in the air!" Jay ignored the warning. He ran across the four lanes and reached the concrete guardrail. He looked out over the edge. He paused. There was nothing between him and the road below but 40 feet of air. Shots were fired. I saw Jay jump. Rich shouted at me, "Get down!" We both ducked below the dash, linked our fingers over the backs of our necks,
as an explosion boomed, rocking our car, setting off the car alarm, blinding us with white light. That sick bastard had detonated his bomb.
3. Rich and I sat parked in the no-parking zone outside the terminal, still reeling from what had happened an eighth of a mile from the airport terminals. We had seen Jay jump from the departures lane to a service road and knew that he had detonated his vest before he hit the pavement. We had tried to guess what he had been thinking. Our current theory was that he hadn't wanted to be captured. He didn't want to talk. Conklin said,
"Maybe he figured jumping off the ramp, he'd land safely on a passing vehicle, like he was in a Jackie Chan movie."
I jumped when someone leaned through the car window. It was Tom Generosa, counterterrorism chief, keeping us in the loop. He said,
"Here's what we know so far. The guy you called Jay had a plan to kill a lot of people inside a crowd, that's not in doubt. His vest was of the anti-personnel variety, packed with nails and ball bearings and rat poison. That's an anticoagulant. The explosion was meant to propel the shrapnel, and it did. But the only casualty was the jumper."
I nodded, and Generosa continued,
"The nails and shit shredded his body and any information he may have been carrying on his person. He left a crater and a roadway full of human tissue and shrapnel."
"And the van?" I said.
"Bomb squad cleared it. The FBI is loading it onto a flatbed, taking it to the crime lab. For starters, Jay stole the van from the market on Turk. Maybe his prints will be on the steering wheel, but I won't be surprised if he can't be positively ID'd."
Generosa told us that federal agents as well as SFPD's crime scene investigation unit were at the site of the explosion now, that the CSI was processing it, and that after it was measured and photographed, the remains of the man known as Jay would be transported by refrigerated van along with explosive samples to the FBI's and the SFPD's forensics labs. Of course, we knew that Jay's bomb had shut down SFO. All airline passengers had been bused to other locations. Outbound flights had been grounded, and incoming flights had been rerouted to other airfields. We could see for ourselves that the terminal buildings were crawling with a multitude of law enforcement agents, from CIA, FBI, DHS, and airport security, as well as their bomb-sniffing dogs. Generosa couldn't estimate with any certainty how long SFO would be out of commission. But as bad as that was for the airlines, their passengers, and traffic, GAR hadn't scored a hit in San Francisco today. We thanked Generosa for the report. He told us,
"Take good care,"
and walked over to the next car in the line behind us. We were about to call in for further instructions when our radio sputtered and Jacoby's voice filled our car. Both Conklin and I had partnered with Jacoby before his promotion to chief. It was so good to hear his voice. He said,
"You two are something else, you know? You cut Jay off from his target. Thank God for that."
I said, "Man, oh man, I can't stand to imagine it." But I did imagine it. I pictured an airport in Paris. I pictured another in Turkey. I could easily see what might have gone down at SFO if Jay had gotten into or even near a terminal. When I first started in homicide, an airport bombing had been inconceivable. Now, these horrifying bombings were almost becoming commonplace. Jacoby's voice was still coming over the radio. He said,
"Effective as soon as you turn in your report, you two are off duty. Boxer, Conklin, I'm proud of you. I love you both. Thanks from me and from Deputy Reardon and a lot of people who've never heard of you and never will. Many lives were saved. Stand down. Come home. The feds are going to take it from here."
I was shaking with relief when I turned the car keys over to Conklin. I got into the passenger seat. I leaned back and closed my eyes as he drove us back to the hall. Part 1. 1 month later. Chapter 1. It was our wedding anniversary. Also, our first date night since Joe and I separated 6 months ago. Joe had surprised me, calling me up as I was leaving work, saying,
"I reserved a window table."
"Say yes, Lindsay. I'm parked right outside." I'd given in, and now we were at the Crested Cormorant, the hot new seafood restaurant on Pier 9, with a front-row seat on San Francisco Bay. Candles flickered on tables around us, as a pink sunset colored the sky to the horizon, tinting the rippling water as the mist rolled in. Joe was talking about his youngest brother.
So at age 40, Petey finally meets the love of his life at a fire department car wash.
He laughed.
Amanda was power washing his white walls, and somehow that jump-starts his heart.
You think her t-shirt got wet? Joe laughed again. I loved his laugh. He said,
very possibly. We're invited to their wedding in Cozumel next month.
Think about it, okay? Looking into my husband's eyes, I saw how much he wanted to bring us back to our wedding in a gazebo overlooking Half Moon Bay. We'd vowed in front of dear friends and family to love each other from that day forward. It had been a promise I knew I could keep. But I hadn't been able to see around corners. Not then. Now, in this romantic setting, Joe was hoping for magic to strike again. As for me, my innocence was gone. I wished it weren't so. I was conflicted. Should I reach across the table, squeeze Joe's hand, and tell him to come home? Or was it time for us both to admit that our Humpty Dumpty marriage couldn't be put back together again? Joe lifted his wine glass and said,
to happy days.
Just then there was a sharp sound, as if the world had cracked open, followed by the boom of rolling thunder and a bright flash on the neighboring pier. I screamed, no! I grabbed Joe's arm and stared open-mouthed across the water to Pier 15, the site of Scientifictron, a science museum called Scitron for short. It was a massive geometric glass and steel structure designed for human interaction with the past and especially the future. The structure was unfolding like a bud bursting into bloom right in front of my eyes. Metal panels flew toward us. A mushroom cloud formed over Pier 15, and an overarching hail of glinting glass shards fell into the bay. Joe said,
Jesus! What the hell?
His expression perfectly mirroring the horror I felt. Another bomb. Scitron was open to the public 7 days a week, but to adults only on Thursday nights. This was Thursday, wasn't it? Yes, people were inside the museum. Was this a GAR attack? Had to be. Joe threw down a credit card, then stabbed at his phone and called his job. Similarly, I called SFPD dispatch and reported what looked to be a mass casualty incident. There's been an explosion with fire at Scitron, Pier 15. Send all cars, FD, bomb squad, ambulances, and find Lieutenant Brady. Tell him I'm on the scene. Joe said,
Lindsay, wait here. I'll be back.
You're kidding.
You want to get killed?
Do you? I followed Joe out of the restaurant onto the walkway that ran the length of the pier. We stood for a long moment at the railing and watched Scitron's two-story metal frame structure crumple as the roof caved in. The sight was devastating and almost impossible to believe, but it was real. Scitron had been blown up. Joe and I started running. Chapter 2. Joe was in the lead as we headed along the pier from the restaurant to the Embarcadero, the major thoroughfare that bordered the waterfront on the western side of San Francisco Bay. When we reached the sidewalk, we turned right and ran another couple hundred yards, past the historic pier bulkhead, stopping short of the entrance to Pier 15. Flames leapt above the smoldering carcass of Scitron. On our left, traffic was going berserk on the Embarcadero. The terrifying sight and sound of the disaster had slowed vehicles to a crawl, causing others to swerve into adjacent lanes while screaming, freaked-out pedestrians fled from the pier and dashed into the road. Brakes squealed and horns blared like it was the biblical end of the world. Explosions have a shattering impact on all your senses. The cracking and ripping sounds, the stink of explosives, the terror on human faces. I knew this from first-hand recent experience, and still, I found it hard to comprehend how a calm and beautiful night had twisted inside out into mayhem and inexplicable destruction. Joe pulled me from the walkway to the railing on the bayside and kept his arm around me as crowds stampeded away from the bomb site and past where we were standing. As I watched the movement of the chaotic scene, I was struck by an anomaly. A man was standing motionless in the middle of the sidewalk, like a boulder in the raging stream of terrified pedestrians. I'm trained to take note of anomalies, and I noticed everything about him. He was white, brown-haired, mid-40s, average height and weight, and wearing jeans, a blue flannel shirt, and wire-framed glasses. A scar cut through his upper lip, drawing my eyes to his thin smile. He was smiling. Was he shell-shocked? Having escaped the blast, was he trying to understand what had happened? Was he transfixed by the explosion itself? Whatever he was thinking or feeling, I was having a cop reaction. In the midst of everything imaginable going wrong, he stood out. I waded across the oncoming rush into his line of sight, flapped open my jacket to show him my badge and to get his attention. Joe was on the phone, but he ended his call and joined me. We stood close to the man in blue, and speaking loudly, I said, "Sir, I'm with the SFPD. Did you see what happened here?" His expression was one of pure, wide-eyed pleasure. He said, "Did I see it? I created this magnificent event. This is my work." This was his work? He was claiming credit? I glanced at Joe like, "Did you hear that? What's your name, sir?" "Connor Grant, citizen, genius, artist par excellence." I said, "I don't understand, Mr. Grant. Are you saying that you bombed Cytron?"
"Exactly."
I was already on adrenaline overload, and it took all my will not to shout, "Are you batshit crazy? There were people in there." Grant was manic or drugged up or something because he kept on talking at high speed.
"Good job, don't you think? Did you see the entire display? The mushroom cloud? Oh my God, it was better than I had even hoped. I'm awarding myself an A+ with extra points for the sundown sky. You want to know why? And I say, why ask why? Beauty doesn't need a reason."
Yes, it was a confession. But was it for real? I asked Grant again if he had actually bombed the museum, and again, smiling like a child on Christmas morning, he confirmed emphatically that he had. "You did this alone?"
"I told you," said the ordinary-looking man in blue. "This is my work. I did it, and I did it perfectly."
"Are you feeling all right, Mr. Grant?"
"Yes, I am. Why do you ask?"
Was Connor Grant, citizen, genius, artist, insane? I didn't know what to believe. Joe had his gun in hand and kept it pointed at Grant as I told him to put his hands on his head. He obeyed me while staring at the destruction, still wearing a beatific glow. I patted him down, found nothing but keys, coins, and a wallet. His ID confirmed his name, and now I had an address and his credit cards. I cuffed the smiling psycho, arrested him for the destruction of public property which would hold him, and read him his rights. Squad cars were screaming up to the curb, and I marched Grant over to one of them. I knew the uniformed cop who scrambled out of the passenger seat. I told young Officer Einhorn and his partner, "Mr. Grant claims that he blew up Cytron. I'm calling Lieutenant Brady now, asking him to meet you at booking. Do not let this man out of your sight until you transfer custody to Brady. I mean, do not take your eyes off him for a second. Any questions, Marty?" After the squad car had pulled out, I speed-dialed Brady and briefed him on Connor Grant, saying that he had taken credit for blowing up Cytron. "I don't know what to make of him, Lou. He says he did it. I'll be coming back to the hall as soon as I can." Joe had been taking photos of incoming law enforcement and activity around the pier. He put his phone away and said,
"Wait here, Linz. I'm going to assess the scene real quick before the fire department tramples it. Be back in 5.
With that, Joe ran toward the wreck of Cytron. I didn't like it. The structure was still smoking and was unstable. Joe was alone. I shouted after him, but it was so loud on the street, I honestly don't think he heard me. Chapter 3. Joe crossed the threshold of what only a few minutes before had been a futuristic science museum. Now it felt as though he were entering a rainforest. The sprinkler system poured water down, and the air smelled of rotten eggs. That meant natural gas, maybe propane, and he picked up other odors. Burning plastic, Hair, flesh. Clouds and fog blocked out the waning light. Looking up, Joe saw only the twisted tracery of trusses and tubular superstructure. Water collected on the floor, which was littered with overturned exhibits and displays torn from the walls. And there were the lumpy shapes of the victims. Aiming blindly, Joe took photos of the debris. The blast had blown out the glass but left the interior standing, so the explosive device had probably not been a manufactured bomb. It seemed likely that the device had been improvised, a compression bomb, a gas-filled container wired with an explosive charge. The attendant flash fire had consumed available combustible materials until the heat had set off the sprinklers. What remained of Cytron was a hazardous obstacle course of smashed glass and sheared-off metal tubing, overturned exhibits, and exposed wiring. Joe carefully picked out a path through the pile of rubble by the light of his phone and the low-burning fires. He called out, "Hello? Can anyone hear me?" There was an answering moan ahead to his right. Joe called out, "I'm coming!" and headed toward the sound when something snaked around his ankle. Reflexively, he kicked his leg free, then made out the pale hand, the arm, the upper torso of a woman lying face down on the floor, half buried under a display case. She said,
"I can't move."
Joe stooped to see her.
"I'm going to help you out of this. What's your name?"
"Sophie Fields."
"I'm Joe. Sophie, are you in pain?"
"I feel numb."
"Looks like an exhibit fell on you. I'm going to try to move it. Hang on."
"Tell my husband, Robbie, I love him. The key is in the tackle box."
"You get to tell him yourself, Sophie. Listen, we're a team now. I'm going to try to move this junk off you. The visibility in here really sucks. If anything hurts you, shout out."
Sophie moaned, and then she was quiet again. Joe sized up the 6x6x12-foot case, which was part metal, part glass, with jagged edges and what looked to be a heavy steel base. If he could get a decent angle and a good grip, if he could lift and shove at the same time, if Sophie weren't pinned by something he couldn't see underneath the display cabinet, a whole lot of ifs. He at least had to try. He told Sophie what he was going to do on the count of three, and then, hoping to God he could do it, Joe got his arms around the plastic backing, bent his knees under the base, and heaved. There was a good deal of creaking and rocking, but the exhibit shifted off the woman's body and then stabilized. Joe was pretty sure Sophie should be able to move if her back wasn't broken. He asked her,
"Sophie, can you roll over onto your side so that you're facing me?"
Joe never got an answer. There was a small blue flash up ahead, like an arc of electricity, followed immediately by a concussive boom. Something heavy struck the back of Joe's head. Sparks flashed in front of his eyes as, weightless, he fell through the dark. Chapter 4. I was in a state of high anxiety as I stood upstream of the exodus from Pier 15, with a clear view of the halogen-lit incident scene. Uniformed cops moved barricades into place on the Embarcadero, closing it off from Bay Street to Market, shutting down local traffic. The incident commander, wearing a neon yellow vest, directed ambulances toward the internal parking area inside Pier 9, which had now become a staging area for medical units. Fire trucks with lights flashing and sirens on full blast drove over the sidewalk and up to the entrance gate. Men and women wearing EMT vests gathered and stood ready as the firefighters went in. Joe had said, "Back in 5. Time was up. When he said that, had he truly believed that a quick look at the scene would take only 5 minutes? His estimate was off, but I resisted the fierce temptation to call him, telling myself that he was working hard and fast and couldn't take time to call me. Still, I was in tremendous conflict. Was Joe in trouble? Had something happened to him inside that bomb site? Should I just stand here, or should I get help? I looked at my watch. He'd been gone for 12 minutes. Now 13. I phoned Mrs. Rose, my neighbor, my friend, and babysitter. I yelled over the noise that I was near Cytron, that I wouldn't be home until late. I was calling Brady when, as if tapping the keypad had triggered it, another bomb went off. The force of that explosion obliterated every other sound, including my own voice screaming, "Joe!" I broke for the entrance to the pier, but before I reached it, I was stopped by three firefighters who blocked my way and pulled me off to the side and out of harm's way. I fought back. "Jesus Christ, I'm a cop! My husband's in there! Give me some help, would you please? I have to find him!" One of the firefighters said to me, "Officer, you can't go in. Not now. Please, stand back. Stand there. We'll get him out as soon as we can." The firefighters were doing their best to control an unstable situation, and I didn't hold it against them. I stood where I'd been directed to stand, out of the path of the rescue squads and with a pretty good view of what had been Cytron's entrance. I prayed that Joe would walk out onto the sidewalk. "Please, God, let Joe be safe." That's what was in my mind when the medical examiner's refrigerated trailer rumbled through an opening in the barricades and parked on the trolley tracks that ran down the middle of the Embarcadero. I turned away from the mobile morgue and looked out over the bay as I called Joe's number again and again, hitting the redial button incessantly and getting no reply. Since Joe wasn't answering, I called my friends and my partner, and I know they heard the terror in my voice. They could do nothing but say, "How can I help?" I said to each, "I'll call you later." And then I was fresh out of lifelines. For the next hour in that horrible, stinking night, I watched as EMTs ran empty stretchers through the museum's shattered entrance and carried bagged bodies out to the sidewalk. There, the dead were lifted into the medical examiner's van. As for the living, firefighters helped some of the blast victims walk out of the museum. Others were carried out on stretchers. I dialed Joe's number. "Joe, answer your phone." This time I thought I heard his ringtone. Five familiar notes getting louder as EMTs rolled a stretcher through the gate and out toward the curb. I ran toward that stretcher, feeling hopeful and terrified at what I might find. I heard the ringtone again. "Joe?" The face of the man on the stretcher was horribly swollen, bruised, and smeared with blood. His left arm rolled out from under the blanket that covered his body, and I saw the wedding ring I had placed on his finger when we were standing together inside a gazebo facing Half Moon Bay. We'd vowed to love each other in sickness and in health. I gripped his shoulder and said, "Joe, it's Lindsay. I'm here." He didn't answer. Was he alive? I ran alongside his stretcher, stayed with him in the triage area, where he was swiftly assessed and lifted through the open doors of an ambulance. I fumbled for my badge and said hoarsely, "That's my husband. I'm his wife." An EMT nodded and offered her hand and forearm. I got a good grip, and she pulled me inside. Chapter 5. I held Joe's hand as the EMTs gave him oxygen, and I answered their questions about Joe's age, blood type, and occupation. Private security contractor. Despite the police barricades and traffic jams, it was a short, wild ride to the hospital. Joe was brought directly from the ER into surgery, and I took a seat in the waiting room. It was filled with people who had emergencies unrelated to the blast, and there were also friends and the families of those victims who'd been caught in the explosion. The overhead TV in the corner was muted, but there was closed captioning and a crawl at the bottom of the screen. "Bomb blast destroys Cytron. Death toll rises to 20 dead, 30 injured. No comment yet from police or Homeland Security, but GAR is suspected as the terrorist organization responsible for this bombing. No one has claimed responsibility." There were video clips of the blast, of the crowds, of the traffic, of the EMTs racing toward the disaster. The clips were horrific, and they triggered my own vivid memories of the explosion I had seen and felt. Images that were playing on a closed loop inside my mind. I was watching the TV when another clip came on. A microphone was put up to the incident commander's face. A reporter shouted a question, and the IC agreed to speak to the press. He gave his name and spelled it, said that he was the commander in charge of managing and coordinating personnel across the board, across several disciplines. He said,
"Fire, medical, and law enforcement are on the scene.
It's much too early to arrive at any conclusions as to what exactly happened here, to identify the victims. We've got great people here, the best. I've got to get back to them. The public will get an update as soon as we have something to report.
Next came a clip of the mayor speaking from outside Pier 15. He was in shirt sleeves and wearing a hard hat. He said,
"This is a terrible day for our city and for the United States. We grieve with the families of the deceased and we pray for the injured. We ask for your patience as we get to the bottom of this savage act of terrorism. Federal agencies have joined with our brave emergency responders and the SFPD. We will get whoever is responsible for this tragedy. You can count on it."
People sitting around me in the waiting room collapsed into the arms of their family and friends and wept. Connor Grant had told me,
"I created this. This magnificent event."
Someone called my name. I jumped to my feet and saw the doctor, a dark-haired surgeon in blue scrubs, mask hanging loosely around her neck. I searched her face for reason to hope for good news, but all I saw was sadness. She introduced herself as Dr. Janet Dalrymple. I walked with her into the hallway, and she told me that Joe had an acute subdural hematoma that was rapidly expanding, that it was putting pressure on his brain. "I put in a shunt to drain the fluid buildup," she told me. "He's on medication to keep the swelling down. What we'll do now is watch him closely, keep checking the pressure." I had to ask, "What are his chances, doctor?" "I don't operate on chances, Lindsay. Every patient with a head injury responds differently. I don't want to give you false hope. His injuries are serious. Still, he could be past the worst in hours. We're taking him now to intensive care." I returned to the waiting room, thinking about the bombshell that had broken up our marriage. 6 months ago, I'd learned that my husband had been lying to me for, I had no idea how long. When I confronted him, he admitted that he'd been keeping things from me, and he said that he couldn't tell me what he was doing, that it was all strictly classified. He said that he had to put country first. Although I maybe still loved him, the words country first changed so many things that I had believed in without question. While I had thought my husband was a work-from-home dad, he had actually been working for the CIA. There was a woman involved. I wasn't sure what they had meant to each other, but it wasn't casual. I was married to a spy. And that meant that I hadn't really known Joseph Molinari, ever. And that I could never truly trust him. Despite how angry I had been with Joe, right now I would do anything if he would survive his injury with his mind intact. I made deals with God, and I waited for news. Chapter 6. News did arrive, but it was not the news I was hoping for. The TV in the soothing ICU waiting room cut away from a rerun of The Big Bang Theory to a bright red breaking news card that spiraled and filled the screen. Then Channel 5's Susan Margulies Steinhardt appeared on set, looking as though she'd just bolted from her bed, put on her lipstick while driving to the studio, and gone directly on air. "We've got breaking news," she said. She read from a sheet of paper in front of her. "Gar has taken responsibility for the bomb that blew up Cytron, resulting in 25 deaths and 45 injuries by recent count." I had been slumped and dozing, but I shot upright and gripped the arms of the chair. The anchor woman went on. "KPIX5 cannot verify the authenticity of this video message that was posted on the internet moments ago." A silhouette of a man appeared on screen. His face was in deep shadow, and there seemed to be a circle behind his head, almost like a halo. His voice was unaccented, digitally altered, could have been completely fabricated by a synthesizer. The man with the distorted voice said, "Gar is proud of our devoted soldier SF-65 in the great anti-establishment reset. He has shown true courage in bringing down Cytron, a frivolous endeavor fed by corrupt corporate and university sponsors. Gar works in secret and explodes in public. And we will continue our work until all people around the world have achieved authority over themselves." The video went to black, and Ms. Steinhardt reappeared on screen. She said, "This is all we have at the moment, but we will continue to update our viewers as new information comes in." And now we are suspending our scheduled programming and taking you to our studios in New York for commentary on the news as it unfolds. Six people in the ICU waiting room were watching this jaw-dropping news along with me.
I knew it, said one. Had to be Gar.
Evil bastards, said another.
On the TV, the scene cut away from the small local station to a slick set in New York. Images of the blast were displayed on large screens behind an angular table seating news correspondents and terrorism analysts familiar to everyone with access to a TV. News anchor Dallas Greer asked the opinions of the experts, and the majority accepted Gar's statement as true. Roger Watkins, CBS's crusty international correspondent, was the dissenting voice. He said,
Although Cytron was funded by corporate donors, it was managed by an ecumenical group of educators. See, that doesn't jibe as I see it. Cytron was not authoritarian in any way. It's a museum that was principally designed for kids. Blowing it up sends a very confusing signal and is off message for Gar.
Alexander Carter disagreed. He had been analyzing and reporting on domestic terrorism since McVeigh bombed the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people in 1995. Said Carter,
Roger, with all due respect, are you suggesting that Gar is taking credit for someone else's bomb? Or could this be more likely? Gar is known for ditching the traditional terrorist playbook. They don't have a headquarters, nor a spokesperson or leader. They thrive on their open-source recruitment and management. Equal bombs for all. How can anyone without certain knowledge say that Cytron was a random act of terror unrelated to Gar?
Both men had made good points, and I was weighing their arguments against what I knew of Connor Grant. Was he a partner in Gar? Was he a lone wolf who had been inspired by Gar? Or if he was in fact the bomber, as I believed, had he acted entirely by himself for his own sick reasons? Or was he innocent of all charges and just a lying piece of crap? I pictured him in a small cinder block interrogation room contemplating a possible death sentence. I thought I could get him to tell me the truth again. Chapter 7. It was almost midnight when Rich Conklin found me in the waiting room outside the ICU. He sat down beside me and I updated him on Joe's condition. They put him into a coma to stop him from thrashing. Along with the bleeding around his brain, he's got a lot of broken bones. Right leg is fractured in two places, right arm burned and snapped just above the wrist. He's got 3 or 4 cracked ribs. Richie is more than a partner. He's like a sibling with no rivalry between us. A couple of years back, he fell in love with and is now living with Cindy Thomas, one of my dearest and closest friends. He is family. Now he walked with me to the glass-walled intensive care unit down the hall, where Joe lay in a hospital bed, tubes going into and out of him. He was wired up to monitors with his leg in traction, bandages around his head. I said, Why did he have to go inside that place? Why?
I know,
Richie said. We both knew. We'd both gone into no-win firefights with eyes wide open, gotten shot, and gone back for more. Richie put his arms around me and I cried against his chest. He said all the right things, that Joe was strong, that he was in great hands, that he was going to live to kick ass.
With his broken leg.
And then he said,
You heard that Gar took credit?
I heard.
We should go, Linz. Brady is waiting for your debrief.
I left my number with the nurse's station and followed Richie back to the Hall of Justice, a gray granite building that houses the criminal court, the DA's offices, a jail, and the southern station of the SFPD. We parked on Gilbert Street and entered the building through the main entrance, a set of double glass and steel doors leading to a marble-lined lobby. We cleared night shift security and headed up the back stairs to the homicide squad room on the 4th floor. The squad room was a fairly grim place on the best of days, but at night it was like a crypt. The lighting was stark, the green walls looked gray, and so did the dear old-timers and rookies and guys on their second shift sharing desks to answer the incessant ringing of the tip lines. Some of them looked up and said, Hey, boxer, you okay? The bullpen was gritty, but there was no place on earth I'd rather work. At the back of the room was a glass-walled office with a princely view of the interstate. This was the lieutenant's office, and he was there now. Jackson Brady, formerly of Miami PD, had transferred to our homicide unit a few years back. It hadn't taken long for him to earn his promotion to lieutenant and become the boss. I'd had issues with Brady at first, but despite his no-frills style, I had come to like him. He was fearless. He was tough. He was loyal to the max, and he was a decider. You couldn't ask much more from your commanding officer. Last year, Brady had married Yuki Castellano, another of my closest friends. Welcome to the family, Brady. He stood up when I entered his small office. He came around his desk and hugged me. He patted my shoulder and asked after Joe. I told him what the doctor had said. We have to wait and see. When we were all seated, I asked about Connor Grant.
He's in a cell by his lonesome, round-the-clock guard, said Brady.
He raked back his longish, white-blonde hair with his fingers and took a long, cold pull from his coffee mug. Then he said to me with a voice still faintly colored by a southern drawl after all these years,
Get talking, Boxer. Don't leave anything out.
Chapter 8. It was almost 2 in the morning when I came through the front door of the apartment I used to share with Joe. It's a roomy space in a former commercial building. The ceilings are high and the kitchen is open to the main room, which is furnished in leather and neutral tones, and has tall windows west and south facing Lake Street. Tonight, home sweet home never felt so good. Martha, my longtime border collie best dog friend, charged across the floor, her barking waking Mrs. Rose, our saintly nanny, who'd been asleep in Joe's big chair. Martha also awakened Julianne, age 22 months, who called out for me.
Mommy!
Be right there, sweetie, I croaked.
You need some honeyed tea for that throat, Mrs. Rose said.
I followed her into the kitchen, and as I washed my hands and face, I told her that Joe's condition hadn't changed. She said she would pray for him, and after she made tea and assured me that both baby and dog had had their needs addressed, I walked her through my front door and across the hall to her own domicile. We hugged, and I said, See you in the morning. See you in 6 hours. Back inside, I went to Julie's buttercup yellow room. My dark-haired, blue-eyed girl was standing up in her crib with her hands up for a hug, which I gave her in full. We have a big JFK-style rocking chair with a cushion and a view. I lifted my sweetie and pulled her into my lap. I rocked as I cuddled with her. I smelled her hair, kissed her fingers, listened to her breathing lengthen before I settled her back down into her bedding. I whispered, I love you so much. Sweet dreams, baby cakes. I checked my cell phone to see if I'd missed a call from San Francisco General. I had not. Martha joined me in the bathroom, watching over me from the bath mat while I showered and scrubbed off the grit and stink of diesel fuel that had glommed onto me that night. As the spray beat down on my back and shoulders, I thought of my poor Joe with his gashed, shaven, and drilled head. His eyes swollen shut, his broken bones. Please, God, don't let him die. I don't remember getting into bed with my best dog friend, but she woofed me awake, and then my phone buzzed. Joe. I grabbed it from the nightstand and saw San Francisco Hospital on the caller ID. I jammed down the green button and said hello to Dr. Dalrymple. She told me,
Joe's condition hasn't improved to my satisfaction. We're going into surgery right now, she said. I'm putting in a second drain.
Oh, no, no.
It's okay, Lindsay. I'll tell you when to get worried. I promise you. Okay?
The doctor did her best to assure me that this second drain wasn't a bad thing and that I should call her later. When I'd clicked off with Joe's surgeon, the phone buzzed in my hand. Brady was calling.
You planning on coming in?
He asked me. It was Friday, right? What time is it?
Time to interrogate the prisoner, he said.
Chapter 9. Brady and I huddled in his office. He gave me the official body count just tallied.
25 people dead, 45 injured, some of them critical, with low to terrible odds of survival.
He handed me a list of the casualties. I skimmed it for Joe's name. Then I folded the paper into thirds and stuffed it into the inside breast pocket of my everyday blue blazer.
You sure you're up to this?
He asked me. I was mad. I was hurting. I was worried about Joe, sleep-deprived, and still in shock from last night's horror show, which would very likely stay with me for the rest of my life. I was stressed to the bone, and I knew that it showed on my face. Still, that Brady even questioned my ability to do the interrogation pissed me off. Who can do this interview better than me? I was there. He talked to me, Brady said.
Okay. I was being considerate. Trying to be considerate. So look, Boxer, here's what we know about Connor Grant.
Brady makes lists. Whenever possible, he writes them in red grease pencil on a yellow legal pad. I looked at the pad. What I saw was a very short list. Said Brady,
he's 45, drives a late model Hyundai, never married, no kids, no family we could find, but there are a lot of Grants in this country. Anyway, he teaches ninth grade science at St. Brendan High School. Been there for about 5 years. Science teacher blows up a science museum. That's interesting, right? His reviews on Rate My Teachers are good. The kids like him.
He doesn't have a sheet?
Nope. He's clean as a nun's habit. A solid citizen, pays his taxes, obeys traffic laws, colors within the lines.
Huh. I find this hard to believe. Brady went on.
Parisi will be observing. Jacoby, too.
I wasn't surprised that the DA and the chief of police would be watching our interrogation. We had an admitted mass murderer in the box. I asked Brady, what else do I need to know?
You take the lead. Be nice. The tape could be used in court. If nice doesn't do the job, I'll step in as badass.
Brady handed me a folder of 8x10 photos. I flipped through them, then looked back into Brady's ice blue eyes. All we had in the way of leverage was Grant's on-the-scene admission. We didn't have it in writing.
Brady said, Boxer, don't worry about the big picture right now. I don't care who he knows, what he hates, etc. If he's talking, great, we want it all. But right now, this morning, be his friend. We just need him to say, I did it. Anything else is gravy.
Chapter 10 Brady and I left his office and walked the short length of corridor to interview two. He held the door open and followed me inside. Connor Grant was seated at the table wearing a bright orange jumpsuit and a smirk. His hands were cuffed, ankles shackled. He looked happy to see me, and oddly, I was happy to see him too. I nodded to the two guards standing in the corners and shot a glance at the red blinking camera eye in the ceiling. Then I looked at the two-way mirror. I was glad that Parisi and Jacoby were behind it. Top brass on deck. Brady had given me a clear-cut assignment. Get Grant's confession on the record. Get it to stick. After that, Len Parisi could negotiate with this monster for convincing details, names of others involved, then either make a deal or prosecute him to the full extent of the law for killing more than 24 human beings. I took a seat in one of the straight-backed aluminum chairs across the table from Grant, and Brady did the same. To the prisoner, I said, Hello again, Mr. Grant. How are you this morning? Sleep okay?
Not bad. I forget. How do I know you?
Last night at the pier. I arrested you, remember?
Oh, right. For destruction of property? I still don't get that.
I opened the folder full of photos and started laying them down on the table. The pictures were post-explosion. The fire licking the foundation of the museum. The emergency vehicles. The stretchers coming out of Citron. The double lines of body bags. And then there were shots from different angles of the museum's metal framework looking like the skeleton of a large prehistoric animal kneeling down on the pier.
Oh, wow, said Mr. Grant. These are great pictures.
Aren't they? If you like, I'll get you copies.
Sure.
Thanks a lot. I smiled at this wretched specimen of a human being. If you could help me by thinking back, I said to Grant, leaning in, crossing my arms on the table, doing my best to look non-threatening, not like a cop at all. I said, Do you remember last night when I asked you if you knew what happened at Citron? I pushed one of the photos toward him. It was time-stamped 7:23 p.m. Smoke was still coming off the rubble heap on the pier. Grant said,
No. What did I say?
You said to me, Did I see it?
I created this. This is my work.
Grant was shaking his head no throughout. I kept my voice soft and pressed on.
You know what really got to me, Mr. Grant?
I tapped my chest somewhere near my heart.
When you told me you wanted to create beauty, you were so happy about the sunset-lit sky.
Gave yourself bonus points for the color of the sky. Too bad we don't have a picture of that, right?
Well, that's just crazy, said Grant with a laugh. How could I take credit for a sunset?
I was prepared for total denial, even though he'd freely offered his confession in the immediate aftermath of the explosion, while glass was still falling from above. For a second, I flashed on Joe. I saw him standing with me, covering Grant with his gun. Joe looked solid, intelligent, brave. This freak, the one with the smirk, had brought Joe down. Grant said,
Oh, I get it now. You're saying that I actually told you that I blew up Cytron? That's hilarious. You must have misunderstood me, Sergeant. Or the explosion affected your hearing. That's possible, isn't it?
He kept talking.
What I must have said was that I saw the explosion, but honest to everything, I had nothing to do with bombing that place.
He made awkward air quotes when he said bombing. I nodded politely. I think I know that this wasn't your doing, Mr. Grant. Not alone, anyway. You had help from a terror network. Maybe they instigated bombing the museum. Maybe they planned it all. Why should you take the heat yourself? He shook his head, said,
Nope. I know nothing about who bombed the museum. It wasn't me.
Had Grant played me then? Or was he playing us now? Was he Gar's devoted soldier? Or here was an idea. Was he teeing up his insanity defense? Brady tensed up beside me. 15 minutes ago, Brady had told me,
Be his friend. We just need him to say, I did it.
What would it take to push that button? It felt to me like Grant had taken a position before we walked into that room. And then he'd dug in. He was entrenched. And he was happy and secure in his foxhole.
Chapter 11. Grant's foxhole wasn't going to protect him or stop me. He had totally denied his confession, acted as though I were the crazy one, and that was infuriating. Still, I couldn't show him my anger. I had to stop thinking that this jerk was making a fool of me and that Brady was sitting next to me. The tape was rolling. All I had to do was get Grant to repeat 3 of the roughly 100 words he'd spoken to me just before I'd arrested him. All I needed him to say was, I did it. He'd been proud of himself when he took credit for the blast, no doubt in my mind about that. I would appeal to his vanity. I moved my chair to the corner of the table so that it wasn't between us and I was sitting closer to him. I made a conscious effort to relax the muscles in my face, and I smiled again at my dear friend Connor Grant. People misunderstand each other all the time. You're upset. Who wouldn't be? You're worried, of course.
Nope.
Mr. Grant, I saw the museum explode. I was right there when it happened, and it was really just awesome. That's why I'm so interested, and when you told me you'd blown it up...
Nope.
I'd really love to know, how did you do it? You're a science teacher, aren't you? Maybe if you just use layman's terms so I can understand you...
Well, I don't understand you at all.
Brady got up from his seat. He's powerfully built, and just his standing up shifted the atmosphere, like when a rodeo bull explodes out of the chute. He spun the chair away from him. It scraped the floor, toppled over, clattered. I bit my lip as Brady slammed both hands down on the table. It shook. As promised, Lieutenant Badass was stepping in. He said,
No more games, sir. We have you at the scene of the bombing. You confessed to Sergeant Boxer and also to Joseph Molinari, who happens to be a former government agent and the former deputy director of Homeland Security. These 2 unimpeachable witnesses corroborate each other's statements, and they will testify against you.
Grant tilted his head back and just looked up at Brady, like he was fascinated.
Your blood test came back, Mr. Grant. There were no drugs or alcohol in your system.
You were flat out sober when you told this officer of the SFPD that you bombed Cytron. That was yesterday. Now we have a search warrant, and we're going to take your house apart, board by board, until we find evidence. When that happens, you're cooked. And I think you know it.
Brady retrieved his chair and sat back down.
Now look, he went on. 25 people have died, man. As soon as we charge you with 25 counts of murder, your name is gonna get out, and the entire city and the whole country are going to be calling for your blood. You wanna live, Connor? You help us, we help you. If you come clean, Sergeant Boxer and I will see if we can get the DA to waive the death penalty. No promises. But this right here is your last best chance.
Grant's